Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you, like the rest of America, are looking to move down here to the Tampa Bay area in Florida and you want to work with a realtor who knows the area well, then make sure you reach out to Ann at West Florida Real Estate. Ann has sold over 350 homes here in the Bay Area over the last 6 years. She's smart, she's lived in the area for 16 years, and you won't find anyone around with a better work ethic. Reach out to her at Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com and let her know you heard about her here on Everyone Loves Guitar. That's Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. For information on advertising, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. And if you're enjoying the show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I'm with one of the hottest blues artists around today. Just ask him. No, I'm just kidding. We're with Alistair Green. He's been a mainstay of the Southern California music scene for over two decades. He's originally from Santa Barbara, and he discovered music through his mom's piano playing at home, actually, in her record collection, which included classics by the Beatles, Stevie Wonder, and Elton John, while his dad's taste leaned towards Bach and Beethoven. He was inspired to pursue music as a career, actually, by his grandfather, the late Chico Alvarez, who played trumpet as a member of the Stan Kenton Band in the 40s and 50s. Growing up, Alistair took piano lessons and played the saxophone before discovering guitar in high school. He got a scholarship to the Berklee College of Music in Boston, where he studied for 2 years before returning to Southern California to begin playing with blues and rock bands in the early 90s. He's put out 8 of his own CDs, including his most recent effort, which is called Live from the 805, which is a double album, 20-song epic record. The Alistair Green Band was formed in 1997, and they've always played a combination of original material as well as covers. Whether with his own band or as part of others, he's opened up shows for the Fabulous Thunderbirds, Robin Trower, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, Lonnie Brooks, Johnny Lang, Billy Boy Arnold, Joe Bonamassa, Mike Campbell's Dirty Knobs, and loads more people. In 2009, he accepted an offer to be the full-time guitarist in the Alan Parsons Live Project in January 2010. You know, I can't help but every time I hear Alan Parsons now, I always did you see like Austin Powers?
Of course.
I like that.
$1 million. Yeah, but
Alan Parsons. I mean, like that, you know, I have like everything he's put out on this, I think, but that's what I think about. This is like being a guy. I mean, that's the problem with testosterone. In November 2014, Alistair toured with Starship featuring Mickey Thomas. He filled in on lead guitar for guitarist John Roth, who's on tour with the rock band Winger. Funny, I got John coming on here, I think, like next week. In May 2007, Alistair left the Alan Parsons Live Project to focus on his own solo career. And the record before him, which we'll talk a little bit about because I didn't get a chance to listen to the new Live at the 805, is Dream Train. Great record. That was released October, literally 1 year ago, October 2017. And we'll talk about that today. Let me just tell you some people that Alistair has performed on stage with, besides Alan Parsons, of course. Anson Funderburg, Bob Margolin, Steady Roland from Muddy Waters Band, Kip Winger, Chester Thompson, of course, from Genesis and Frank Zappa, Damon Fowler. He's from down here, man.
Yeah, Damon's great, man.
Yeah, right. And he plays a gold top telly with two humbuckers.
Well, yeah, I think he's got P90s in that thing. Yeah, it's
cool. Oh, is that what's in there?
I've gotten to play it. Yeah, it's a great guitar.
Who makes that guitar? Is that a Fender custom shop?
I don't know. I didn't see it. I don't think it was a Fender, but I got to play it just like a few weeks ago in Vegas. Yeah.
Cool. Eric Burden from the Animals. Eric Gales, not from the Animals. Gary Hoey, Jimmy Vivino. A lot of these guys have been on the show. Kim Simmons and Savoy Brown. What a great player that guy is, man.
Yeah.
Kirky Fletcher, Michael Burks. I'm going to talk about Michael, actually. Robert Randolph, Slash. Again, Starship featuring Mickey Thomas and the Walter Trout Band. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. I was almost impressed with my own bio. Thank you for reading it back to me.
Yeah, we're done. First of all, congratulations, man. You just released your 8th album and, you know, we kind of talked a little bit before the show. Most people are really where a lot of people are just releasing EPs now simply because of the state of the music business and the fact that you know, nobody buys records. Your new album has 20 tracks, double CD. The last album, 2017's Dream Train, had 13 tracks. Yeah. So to me, that means you're like super driven. And I was curious where this drive comes from and what motivates you to do stuff like that.
Well, driven and stubborn and insane, probably. You know, I guess I kind of continue to make music and try and release records in the way that I grew up enjoying them. And if I was in love with an artist and really dug their music, I'd be stoked if they released a double life record. And you know, I think it just depends on when you're in the studio, especially with like a studio recording. You may end up with 13 songs you want to put out. You may end up with nine. You know, it just kind of depends on, you know, what you're kind of shooting for. And but yeah, I've tried to kind of put a lot of music on the CDs when I can. You know, the live record, the reason we, well, one of the reasons I did 20 tracks is it was kind of a celebration of 20 years of my band at the time of the recording. You know, I did form my band in 97, 98. You know, we did the show. We were originally scheduled to do the show late last year, but there's the, I don't know if you remember, there's a lot of fires in Southern California.
Yeah, sure.
The venue we were going to record at in Santa Barbara, the fire got really close to Santa Barbara and the whole town was smoked out. So we ended up rescheduling. So we recorded in March of this year. And 20 songs for 20 years just kind of made sense to me. I mean, we played and recorded like 30 something songs that night. It was a pretty long evening. I wanted to get a lot of stuff on, a lot of stuff recorded. But yeah, man, I, you know, try and put as much music out there as you can while you're alive, I think is one of my goals.
That's very cool.
What else am I going to leave behind?
That's really cool. It's just a lot of work, man. I give you very much credit and respect for that.
Well, thanks.
Another thing you did that I thought was unusual or kind of big is you grew up in Southern California and then you went to Berkeley on the other coast. And I was curious what was so compelling at Berkeley over, you know, Musicians Institute, or maybe it was called Guitar Institute back then, and or Berkeley or Southern California or USC music. And
interestingly, I was in the school jazz band, my high school jazz band, and we actually went to Florida. We went to Disney World area, and there was a big jazz band competition there. This would have been 1988 or 89 when I was a senior. And I don't want to give the impression I know how to play jazz guitar, because I don't, but I was in the jazz band basically playing seventh chords and pentatonic licks. And but first there was a guy there from Berkeley that was giving out scholarships. And so I ended up receiving a partial scholarship to Berkeley. And you know, my parents had a little bit of money saved. My grandmother had a little bit of money saved. I applied for another scholarship locally out here. And so that was kind of what was the catalyst for attending Berkeley was, you know, and I also had I had a friend at the time that was attending. So I got to go back out there and kind of check out the school before I attended. And I, you know, it was a cool man. And I spent 2 years there before I came home. But that was the reason. It's because, hey, man, they're going to give me money.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
A good motivator.
Oh, totally, man. Did you meet any players there that you are either still friends with today or that are have pretty good careers going today themselves?
Yeah, man. It's really interesting. When I was there, there's a lot of great players, you know, some of which have gone on to some of the highest levels in the business. Abe Laboriel Jr. was there.
Wow.
When I was there. So, you know, and he's playing with Paul McCartney. Can't really get doesn't get much bigger than that.
No.
Brian Beller was there. He was a bass player who's been on the road with Satriani and Vi and Mike Keneally. I'm trying to think who else was there that I'm still in touch with. I mean, there's a lot of guys that I was there that I'm still in touch with. Unfortunately, one of my friends passed away recently that was there. His name is Kato Kundwala, who
was a
record producer. Yeah, he passed away recently.
Wow.
Freak motorcycle accident. Who else was there? This is a great question. Now I'm trying to rack my brain about who was there. There's a couple great guitar players that really kind of were more in the blues vein. that people may or may not know of, a guy named David Steele, who lives in Southern California now. He was from Indiana, and he was still a fantastic guitar player. I think he's gotten into some other stuff, but he moved to Nashville for a little bit and did some touring, I think, with Pam Tillis and some more country artists. So he was there. I'm trying to think, man. I know there were some other people. If I think of them over the course of the interview,
blurt it out.
Exactly. So,
how'd you wind up getting the gig with Alan Parsons, and what were you doing at the time musically before you got the gig?
Well, I've been doing my band, like I said, since the late 90s. But in that time, late 90s, early 2000s, I was pretty much playing with anybody that needed a guitar player. I was playing in an R&B funk band. I was, getting calls randomly to fill in on some other blues gigs here and there. One of the artists I was playing, like, in kind of a singer songwriter Americana band a little bit. And then one of the artists that I was playing with, a guy named Mike Dawson, who was kind of more of a country rock artist. He was a DJ. He works, I'm not going to remember the name of the show, but he's working with, a big time comedian now, but he was a DJ at the local radio station, and he'd met Alan at some fundraiser that radio stations do or whatever. And he'd met Alan and become friends with him. And then he was finishing up a record and was doing overdubs in Alan's home studio with a different engineer.
Alan Parsons used a different engineer.
Yeah. Well, cause it was like, he had someone else, he wasn't going to go and engineer overdubs for somebody's record for free, basically. So I donated his studio, and someone came in to engineer. And so I came in and did some guitar work on this country rock record for my buddy Mike, and Alan kind of popped his head in the studio and hung out for a little bit. And there was kind of a defining moment. I was playing some rhythm part on some song, and Alan sat down in the chair, and I was like, oh shit.
The guy who engineered Dark Side of the Moon is watching me. Yeah.
So I was playing, I was overdubbing some rhythm parts, and I was kind of going through, and I started a take, and in the middle of the take, so I'm recording a rhythm part, and Alan blurts out, he says, "You remember that thing you did two takes ago in the bridge? Play that again."
I'm recording.
So the tape's rolling. I mean, it wasn't like a hard song, it was like a C, G, D, something or other. But I remember in my head going like, man, if I nail, can I swear on your show? Is that okay?
You could say whatever the fuck you'd like.
Okay, cool. But I remember in my head, I was going, man, if I fucking pull this off, I'm going to be the man right now. Because it was, literally like remembering what I did two takes ago while the current take was being recorded. So I did whatever it was, and at the end of the session, he asked me for my phone number, and then a year later, I got a call from him saying that he was recording a record, and would I be interested in coming and playing a solo on it? And I was like, yeah. And so I went up to his studio, and that was another funny thing, because I recorded actually a couple different solos. The record's called A Valid Path, and it was the last studio record that he'd put out. And I played a couple solos on it, and I asked him, I said, who else played on your record? You can get anybody you want. Who else played on this? And he goes, oh, someone named David Gilmour played a solo. And so that was kind of one of my early things I hung my hat on. I was like, well, I played on a record, and there's two guitar solos on it. One of them's mine, and one of them's David Gilmour's.
Yeah.
But so we, kind of developed a friendship to an extent back then, and he wanted to redo his band. He had guys that were in New York at the time. He kind of got new bands based on, I think, where he lived and what was going on with his career. He had English guys for a while, and then he moved to the States, and he got guys from New York. And then, while he was out in California, he ended up hiring people that were kind of a little closer to where he was. So
was he near you?
He's in Santa Barbara. I'm down here in Ventura. But I'd actually subbed for the old guitar player at the time, Godfrey Townsend, who's, if you haven't checked him out, he's fantastic, and you might want to consider him as a guest.
Yeah, man.
He played in the John Entwistle band.
Oh, wow.
He just actually got the gig playing guitar with the current configuration of the Yardbirds. I can put you in touch with him, but
Cool, man.
He was playing with Alan. I think, I don't know how long he was in the band, 5-6 years, but he had a commitment with something else, another tour. So I ended up subbing for him in 2009 for a handful of shows. And it was shortly after that, that Alan wanted to kind of revamp his band. So I officially joined in 2010 and I officially left in 2017 or 16. I don't know. What did I say?
17.
What year is it? What year are we in?
I think 17.
What year is it?
It's 18, yeah. I think, right? Yeah, it's 18, almost 19.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I got the gig. I was just kind of around and playing and subbed for the guy that I ended up, you know, replacing. So
that's awesome. That's just how it works all the time.
Yeah, it was a pretty organic thing. I think, you know, a lot of times there's not that sort of random lightning striking thing. It really is about the relationships you have. I don't know. I mean, obviously there's probably still circumstances, like in the case of someone like Zach Wilde, where everyone sends in their audition tapes, you know, and they listen to the tapes and that's the guy, you know, or let's, you know, bring in, you know, I have a friend of mine that I went to junior high and high school with, Chris Shiflett and the Foo Fighters. And
he's right.
Been
in the Foo Fighters that's for, right.
I don't know how long. And, you know, I think that was a big audition process. I think they brought in a bunch of people and then, you know, he ended up getting the gig. So, it really depends. But yeah, that the Alan thing kind of just came about fairly organically. It's a fairly small community in Santa Barbara with the musicians and whatnot. So I, you know, kind of had a little bit of that big fish, small pond thing as far as getting that gig.
Yeah, but good for you, man. What the hell? It's got to go to somebody, right?
Yeah, well, no, it was fun while it lasted.
What made you leave?
I got to a point where I, you know, wanted to do my thing. The band had changed as far as the personnel was concerned. It's kind of been there, done that a little bit. I mean, it was great. I mean, the thing I miss most is, you know, a couple of the guys in the band and, you know, playing, you know, for large audiences and around the world. But, you know, musically, that was never my thing. I think there's some players that will go do a gig and do it forever because it's at that level or, you know, at that, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, for me, I like the music and I really grew to appreciate the music. And I did fall in love with some of the songs, you know, but I felt a little bit like a you know, whatever you want to call it, a square peg in a round hole.
It's not what you're playing now. You're a blues guy.
I'm a blues rock guy. You know, I'm a Clapton, Cream, Jimmy Page guy, you know, early Jeff Beck group kind of dude. And I learned a ton, but it kind of got to the point where it's like, you know, I've been doing this and it's been great, but you know, I just want to see what else there is out there. And like I said, I'd kind of, you know, lost a little bit of interest when the personnel kind of started to change. Things started getting a little funky in there. And, you know, Alan, you know, he's kind of got his opinion about how things should be. And I respect that, but I was ready to move on at a certain point, you know.
Good for you. I give you credit for that, man.
It's funny because my rock and roll friends go, man, you're crazy to leave a gig like that. And then all my blues rock friends are like, oh, well, man, if you want to have your own career, you're going to have to leave. So, you know, you could look at it a couple of different ways. I mean, I get that those kind of gigs don't happen that often. You don't get that kind of gig that often.
Correct.
Especially coming from where I was coming from musically. And so I am thankful I got to do it and learned a lot and see the world and, you know, meet a lot of people and whatnot. But, you know, I wanted to kind of, you know, play music that was closer to my heart.
Yeah.
So,
but if you're in a marriage, man, and if it's, or any relationship, and if you're not, you know, if you're getting to the point where you're just like not having fun, it's just, it's not fucking fun, you know, period. Yeah, it doesn't matter how much.
You're doing a lot of traveling and stuff. And if, you know, something kind of, you know, and, you know, negativity just can kind of grow unless you address it.
For sure.
And I tried addressing it, and that's when I kind of hit a brick wall, is trying to address certain things. And if people aren't open to discussion or talking about things like that, then it's like, then you're like up against it. And it's like, well,
so. Good for you, man. Hey, are you happier?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm happier, and it's opened me up also for other opportunities too. You know, now, I mean, it's interesting when you have something like that, you know, people think, oh, well, he's just not available. You know, that guy's not available to hire or anything. And the fact of the matter is, the busiest I ever was in that band, which was 2013, 14, 15, you know, the most shows we ever did in 1 year was 50 shows. And
that's a lot
when you're flying places and stuff like that, you know, but that was the most. And so it was never the kind of thing where that was the only thing I could do.
Okay.
Because it financially, without, you know, getting too deep down that, you know, it wasn't the kind of thing where I could just sit around when I got off a tour.
Sure.
And, you know, sit back and, you know, rest on my laurels. I'd get home and I'd have a gig with my band 2 days later. You know?
Yeah.
And so it wasn't financially, yeah, it was cool when it was happening, but it wasn't happening on the kind of basis where, I mean, I guess if I lived, you know, somewhere where it's really inexpensive to live, yeah, I could have, you know, done that. But it was the kind of thing where it's like, financially, it wasn't, you know, a sit back and wait for the next, you know, tour to come to pop up, you know?
No, I totally get it. Have you had the same guys in your band since 97?
I have not. I've had the same bass player, Jim Rankin, for about 10 years, coming up on 11. And I've kind of been going through a few different drummers.
Everybody fucking goes through drummers, man. It's well, like, you
know, yeah, it's tough, man.
God, everybody.
The guy that's played on the last three studio records, Austin Beattie's, you know, been around in the band, I think probably since, what is it, 18, probably 5 or 6 years, but we've been touring mostly with a guy named Anthony Ambrose. He's a great young drummer. And, you know, the tough thing is, depending upon where you are on the career ladder, is it's hard to keep guys consistently if you're not paying their bills. And that's,
yeah, absolutely,
you know, so it's kind of this thing where it's where everyone's trying to make a living, or maybe someone has a day job or whatever it is. And so it can be really difficult. And especially, you know, again, not to say that living in Southern California is bad by any means, but, you know, I mean, well,
it's costly. Yeah.
It's costly. You know, we pay the big weather tax.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
And so that's, you know, been a challenge. But my band started off with a couple of guys that were in a blues band from the area called the Pontiacs. Mm. And the Pontiacs, great, great, I guess traditional in the way that they were, you know, kind of a harmonica fronted Chicago meets Texas style blues band. And the rhythm section that I originally had for my band was the drummer and the bass player from the Pontiacs. And so that was about the first, I don't know, 5, 6 years. And then Jim joined the band. And I mean, I've played with, there's been a lot of guys that I've had sub in my band. I mean, you can go play a blues gig with no rehearsal with guys that know the language.
Sure.
I've always wanted to be able to do original songs that take a little bit of rehearsing or, you know, doing,
but yeah.
So I've gotten to play under my name with a lot of great players. But as far as the consistent guys lately, it's the last 5, 6 years, you know, it's been, Jim on bass and, Austin or Anthony on drums.
Cool. So, yeah. I'm going to throw out names of some artists, and if you could talk about how you got the gig working with them or what the experience is like and any cool stories. I mentioned I'm a fan of Kim Simmons and Savoy Brown.
Oh, yeah. I was on a festival with them in 2014 or 15, and he's on Roof Records. I don't know if he still is, but he had a couple records for Roof, and my publicist Amy Bratt was, you know, does some work for Roof. And so when I met Kim, I kind of had a, you know, a common friend there, as well as just me being a big fan of English blues rock. And so when I met him, we, you know, we hit it off, and then I saw him again. We did another festival. Was it last year, a couple of years ago in Southern California. And he invited me to come sit in. Yeah, so it was cool, and I saw him again recently this year in Memphis, where actually we got to do a cover photo shoot for a Big City Rhythm and Blues magazine. So the covers, Kim, myself, Bob Margolin, Laura Chavez, and Walter Trout on the cover of this. And Kim's great, man. He's a super sweet guy.
Great tone, man.
great tone and just been doing, I mean, think about, I mean, he was there when all that stuff was happening in the '60s in England, and, but he's still out there doing it, you know, and I think partially because he loves it and partially, I mean, he's, you know, not necessarily a household name like he should be.
No, he's,
So he's still out there doing it, man, making records and playing great. He's got a trio and I'm not sure how much they're touring, but, it's great to hear him play, man. He's it's inspiring because he's one of those guys where you can listen to those old Savoy Brown records and go, yeah, man, that guitar player is really good. And I don't know, he's 20 something when those were recorded.
Yeah,
but he hasn't stopped playing, and he sounds killer. I mean, he really, I think he's one of those guys that, you know, just getting better as time goes on, and still seems very passionate about playing the guitar.
That's awesome, man. It's funny, I had Bob on the show too. He's like a Bob Marcolin, he's never going to stop. You know, he'll be playing a guitar in his, you know, grave, man. In his,
yeah,
in his coffin.
Bob's great. Yeah. I've gotten to play with Bob a bunch and I've opened for him and I've sat in with him and played with him quite a few times. And that guy's a force in nature on the guitar. It's a thing. It's a thing when he starts playing, man.
Well, this guy was too, unfortunately, passed. Michael Burks.
Oh, yeah.
I saw him. Big guy. He reminded me like of Albert King. He was a big guy, and he played what looked like on him a tiny little Les Paul.
Yeah,
and I think it was actually I had interviewed years ago or very early on Doug Cower from Cower Guitar.
Cower Guitar. He was using a Cower for a while.
It was a small Cower, and I had my son with me, and I said, Nick, it was an intimate. Have you ever played down in this area?
I did a couple tours of Florida with Alan when I was playing in his band. We did a handful of days.
Yeah, you're not playing where Michael was playing. He played a little place called Skippers. It's a great place.
I've heard of it. Yes. I've got friends that play there. Yeah, Albert Castilla is in Florida and Damon Fowler.
I know Damon's played there. You know Sean Chambers?
Yeah.
Sean's
I mean, I don't know him. I know who he is. We've exchanged some messages on Facebook. Yeah, I know who he is.
He's a really good guy. He's played down there a bunch. But and we were standing like right in front of him. I told my son, I said, Nick, you're lucky you're seeing this because the next time around, this guy's going to be in theaters. You're not going to be 6 feet away from him. And then three weeks later, he died. He walked off a plane in Atlanta.
Yeah, he had a heart attack coming off a plane from Europe. Well, I did a festival with him. 2011, maybe, you know, 12, I don't know, right around in there. And my band played early in the day. He was playing later, but the promoter put together this, I guess, kind of guitar round table discussion where we all kind of hung out on a stage with our guitars. Cool. And he was scheduled to be there. And that's where I met Nick Moss. I don't know if you're familiar with Nick Moss. Moss is a great Chicago. He's another guy you got to look up. His new record's out on Alligator Records. I've known him for a while. He's a killer blues guitar player. Absolutely killer. Anyhow, he was there. That's where I met him for the first time and a couple other guys from that region. And Michael Burks was late getting there. And then he came down, we just kind of were telling stories and we played a little bit and he was just really complimentary of my playing was just really nice. And talk about a guy that was, you know, I know that the term the real deal gets thrown around a lot. But, you know, in this kind of music, you know, and he would rock. I mean, too. I mean, it wasn't like he was just a straight up traditional guy.
No, he was shred.
His records, you know, he did some rock. He did some kind of more of the R&B stuff. You know, he could play traditional, I'm sure, if he wanted to. But so I got really into him and bought some records. And actually, after he passed, the record that I put out in 2014, it's called Trouble at Your Door. We actually covered, there's one cover song on that record, and it's a Michael Burks song.
Oh, that's nice, man.
We did it a little bit different. But yeah, he was just fantastic. I figured he was as good of anyone to kind of pay tribute to by recording one of his songs.
Yeah,
so
that's a sweet thing to do. I think that was real nice and very appropriate. Yeah. And how about Robert Randolph, another guy I've seen in concert?
Amazing. I was lucky one night. There was a benefit show in Santa Barbara for what's called Notes for Notes, which is basically getting instruments into the hands of kids that, you know, aren't financially as well off. And So this, and Seymour Duncan's one of the sponsors.
Wait a minute. Jimmy, kid's not as financially well off as blues guitar players. What the fuck?
No. I mean, no, kids are financially, no, I didn't say blues guitar. Just kids that aren't, you know, doesn't need help with getting instruments. And, and Seymour Duncan's one of the sponsors. And Jimmy Vivino is usually the music director.
Great guy.
For these shows. And that year, which is, I think, at the end of 2013, Alan was playing. And so I went to, you know, play with Alan. We, you know, did two or three songs. And at the end, Robert Randolph was on the gig on the show, and Slash was on the show, and, you know, Jimmy Vivino and his band. And so at the end, there was a, you know, big finale jam. And so I, you know, who's not going to want to go out there and stand on stage with Slash and Robert Randolph and Jimmy Vivino?
Yeah.
And it was funny. I was on the side of the stage when Robert Randolph was playing. And, you know, a couple songs had been thrown around as far as what the jam song at the end of the night was going to be. And one of the songs, I think, was like Statesboro Blues or something. And so anyhow, Robert Randolph's up there playing, you know, doing his thing. And I was just kind of under my breath. I'm like, well, I'm not playing any slide guitar tonight. That's and I heard this chuckle, and I looked over my shoulder, and it was Slash. And I'm like, oh, you know, I guess if you can make Slash chuckle, that's fun. And I met Slash later on, you know, the night, and he's like, ah, it was really funny what you said about, right? I was like, man, that guy plays slide. I mean, he's doing it on, you know, on a pedal or lap steel or whatever. It's like, you know, that stuff's just, that's crazy. That's some crazy playing, man. And really inspiring to hear him take that instrument so far, you know. And I didn't get to like hang with him all that much or whatever, but it was, you know, it was fun getting the photo op.
I saw him down here. He had a pretty big band, if I remember correctly. It was like, you know, the full band and then three or four singers. It was quite a big band, you know.
It's a lot of sound.
Yeah, a lot of sound. Hey man, let's talk about your last record, Dream Train. I listened to it.
Okay.
Loved it. Great blues record. But here's my notes. It's also straight up hard rock. Exactly what you're talking about, man.
Yeah.
A few tracks I want to talk about. One song called Another Lie. I thought it was amazing. Walter Trout's in there. And if you're a guitar player, this is one of those songs, like, it's impossible to not grab your guitar and just start jamming. It's that kind of song. Again, it's called Another Lie from Dream Train. Who's singing on that? Is that you or Walter?
That's me. No, that's me.
Dude, your voice is awesome.
Hey, every once in a while, man, I get lucky.
Yeah. But you know who you sound like when you talk? Like, there's a comedian, and I can't think who. You sound just like him.
Oh, really? I don't know if that is that a good or a bad thing.
It's just who you sound like. It's like a very familiar voice. It's a good. I mean, his voice is fine. Yeah. You know, it's just, but your singing voice is great, man.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, that's, you know, that's something that has not come naturally, and that I still try and work on. I don't really consider myself. I use the term singer sometimes. Like, I can, you know, I sing and I guess I'm a singer, but I don't consider myself like a singer.
I get you.
You know, like when you hear guys that really sing, Paul, you know, in this genre, you know, Paul Rogers, you know, Greg Allman, Warren Haynes, you know, I mean, talking about, you know, more blues rock guys, obviously, you know, blues singers, Bobby Bland or BB King or, you know, or Magic Sam, you know, those are, to me, those are singers. Those are guys that really sing. And, you know, I've done what I can, you know, out of just wanting to be able to challenge myself to do that. And also out of, you know, well, all my heroes, you know, most of my heroes sang in front of bands, whether it's, you know, Clapton or Hendrix or Stevie Ray Vaughan. But I appreciate you saying that. And that song, Another Lie, you know, I was kind of going after, you know, talk about another great singer, Otis Rush, who just passed away recently. But I intentionally kind of made that song kind of that Otis Rush kind of slow minor blues type of thing. And, you know, we made the turnaround, you know, it wasn't a typical 5/4 turnaround. I think it's whatever, flat 6, flat 7 turnaround, excuse me. And,
That was Alistair, not me. I just want that to go
another cup of coffee
for the record.
you know, I met Walter. I'd known Walter for a little bit, and I'd, you know, gotten to sit in with him. And I was thinking with that record, I really wanted to kind of bring in a few people. You know, again, it was one of those records where I really wanted to swing for the fence. And we, you know, brought in David Z to produce, and he brought in the previously unreleased Billy Gibbons song that we recorded. And I wanted to bring in some guests. I wanted to bring in some guitar player friends that I had met and looked up to. And that's where, you know, Walter was the first guy, you know, called. Mike Zito already told me that he'd play a solo on it. But before I got, you know, Mike's solo, I think I'd talked to Walter and just asked him if he'd do a solo on the record. And we went down, Sean McHugh, who engineered that one and engineered the live one and the one before that, the Trouble at Your Door record. We went down to Walter's house and just kind of set up a little mobile recording unit, and we're playing the song to him. We just barely gotten everything set up and mic'd his amp in the bathroom, and we just kind of got the monitors barely set up and just start, here's the song. This is what it is. It's in B, and the turnaround goes like this. And about halfway through the song, he starts noodling, and we're like, fuck, better just press record now. Like, literally, it was just start recording. And so we, you know, he basically recorded half the song, and then we did another take, and that was it, and it was over, and it was done. And I actually filmed a little bit of it on my phone. I was just real sly. I was just kind of like, just getting a little bit. So I've got a little bit of video.
Oh, that's cool.
But. Yeah, I mean, Walter's one of those guys that he's been playing at such a high level with, you know, obviously, you know, Canned Heat and John Mayall and everybody that he's played with and his own, you know, solo career. I think guys like that have been playing that long, it's just going to happen in that first or second take, because they're just breathing.
Yeah.
I've gotten lucky a few times and, you know, gotten some first takes here and there. And I'm shooting for, you know, hopefully that gets, you know, more and more consistent as I get older. But, you know, that guy just has been breathing and living guitar for so long. And he was right at home, and that he did make one funny comment. He's like, what key is this? I'm like, B minor. He's like, who writes in fucking B minor? I was like, it's not that uncommon. You know,
it's not that uncommon,
but it was pretty funny.
That is funny, man. Very cool. Yeah. Are you both playing strats on there?
No, I actually played a 335 on that. It was funny because, you know, since I recorded, you know, what you hear on that track is, you know, the band played the song live. So the drums, bass, and the guitar was all recorded together at the same time without, you know, overdubs. And then I overdubbed. So in my head, I was kind of thinking about where the vocal was going to be. And I knew that Walter was going to play on it, so we left him holes in some of the verses to fill, and we obviously left him a solo section. And then, you know, the third time around, or whatever it is in the solo, was going to be both of us playing at the same time. So I was kind of in my head sort of imagining him playing with his tone and stuff. And, you know, and then we also overdubbed organ on that. Mike Finnegan played Hammond on that song and a couple other songs, who's, you know, he's Bonnie Raitt's organ player, and Taj Mahal, and he plays in a band called the Phantom Blues Band, and he's just a
Mike Finnegan or Mike Flanagan?
Mike Finnegan.
Okay.
He's a Southern California guy. Yeah, look him up. He is just a stone cold killer on that, and nice guy. And so, you know, that track, you know, yeah, it was kind of put together as far as, you know, overdubs and whatnot. But I figured if Walter was gonna play a strat as distorted as he, you know, plays, as overdriven as he plays, I was going to go 335, not quite as overdriven, to really kind of have that separation of the sounds, just so you could really hear two distinct tonal characteristics. You know, he's a Strat guy to the bone from forever, and I tend to kind of play different guitars all the time.
Yeah, I've seen you with a bunch of different guitars.
Yeah, so I haven't, I've got a couple guitars that I really like and resonate with and have had for a long time, but I don't really have an allegiance to, you know, I'm not like a Rory Gallagher kind of guy where it's like, that's that guy's guitar.
Yeah.
He'll pick up a Telly to play some slide every once in a while, but that's his Strat, you know?
Sure.
So.
Well, the song is great. Another song that I thought was really cool is something called I'm the Taker. It's a hard rock song, great riffs. But it kind of sounds like an old school 60s song. It's got a cool vibe because, like, the hi-hat's going on almost all four beats, it sounded like.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, I'll tell you a secret about that song that you you'll think is funny after I tell you what it is. That's basically Couldn't Stand the Weather in a half step difference. Like all the chord progression that happens. I mean, the vocal melody is different. I think I go to the four chord in the verse, but as far as the chords that happen and what I consider to be the chorus, I just lifted those straight out of the song Couldn't Stand the Weather.
Interesting.
And yes, and even, you know, the riff, you know, it's based on, God, it might even be in the same key because we didn't tune down a half step because I think Couldn't Stand the Weather, is that in D?
He usually
be tuned down a half step, so be in whatever that is, C sharp or something. Anyhow, that's where I kind of lifted the chords from. And even the idea for that riff, I haven't been a big, I'm a huge Steve Ray Vaughan fan, but I've tried intentionally not to really ape his vibe, but I'm a huge fan of his songwriting as well as just his ability to wield guitar. And I loved that song and the chord progression and how he was able to kind of make it this blues thing. And we did, I think I played an SG on that song and obviously with more gain or whatever, but yeah. And a lot of people have told me, they think that sounds kind of Robin Trower-ish too.
Great. Yeah. Very, like I said, old school 60s. I really dug it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about cool. Love Robin Trower, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the, is there a backstory to that song?
Not really. I had a couple of those lyrics just kind of laying around for a while. Lyrics, I will kind of find a line or two that I think are good, and then I'll try and just build a story around it a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. It's most of the time it's not really based on any events, or anything. I try and find and write things that I find interesting story wise.
Sure.
And even you can even find a couple lines that inspire you to finish a story. I think the first lines, I'm trying to access the memory file in my brain, but I think the line that really kind of got me started on that song was something like the road to heaven comes awfully close to hell or something like that, where it's like a little bit dark.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I kind of, off of that, you can just, if you have a line or two, sometimes that's where the song goes and your story develops around that. You know, it's kind of like when you're doing a jigsaw puzzle and you just kind of figure out a couple pieces. You don't know what the rest of the puzzle is going to be right. Like until you actually put it together. And lyrics for me tend to kind of be that way, where you have a couple things and it's like, oh, this is obviously going to be a story about that or, about that. You know, so.
That's cool, man. And then you got a really nice, a pretty electric guitar instrumental track on there called Iowa. Yeah. And I was curious what guitar you're playing on there. It's like a mid-rangey or lower-end sounding, but it sounded perfect for that music.
Oh, that's the 335, man. I'm telling you, that's a magic guitar. I got that guitar. It's probably been longer than I think because time's passing by a lot faster. But I got that guitar 5-6 years, maybe more. I don't know. I've had that guitar for a little bit. And as soon as I get guitars, I usually put Seymour Duncan pickups in them because I've known Seymour since, I was a kid.
You wouldn't do that with a vintage guitar though.
I don't have any vintage guitars. Who can afford vintage guitars?
I'm just asking. Yeah.
That was a 335 and I'd actually had a lot of that song written, and I'd actually tried recording it a couple times before. That song goes back to like the early 2000s. I had
some of those
chord progressions, and it just, the solo section used to be a little different, and I finally kind of changed it around, and I named it Iowa. That's where my dad grew up in Iowa for a large portion of his life, and my grandmother lived back there up until she passed away. So I'd gone back to visit her once when I was a kid. And I went back and saw her before she passed. And so that's basically a song for her. And a few years ago, and actually we just got home from a little tour of the Midwest. I've actually played in Iowa a few times with my band and the vibe of that song, that's why, like you said, it's kind of a mellow Hendrix-y, Floyd-y thing. And just kind of, to me, if I close my eyes and play or live or listen to that song, it just kind of conjures up those real just far reaching plains and fields and whatnot.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to listen live at the 805, but why don't you talk about what gets you most excited about this record?
My guitar tone.
playing, the solos,
there's solos on every song. I always say that sarcastic. Oh man, you'll love the record. There's a guitar solo on every song.
Yeah.
I'm really happy that I was able to capture what I consider, what we do live and
this one show, get that right.
Huh?
That's one show.
One show, yeah. Man. And, we played well, it was a well attended show. Sonically, I'm really happy with how it came out. Sean McHugh engineered and mixed it and mastered it and co-produced it with me. And, he took a line out of the mixing board. We set up a couple mics, a couple extra mics that the club didn't normally use. I think, we put a couple overheads over the drums, and I used two, I had two amps going, and I think I even recorded a direct signal we didn't end up using. But sonically, I'm really happy with how it turned out. Playing wise, I'm pretty happy. I tend to, it's interesting. After I listened to the record, just to go off on a little tangent.
Yeah.
I've always kind of prided my, I've always kind of said, well, I like, I love Clapton and Cream, and I love, Hendrix and Rory Gallagher and all these guys as far as, the trio thing. But after I listened to the live record, I was like, man, I really owe Jimmy Page more of a shout out than I normally give him. Mainly because I play pretty sloppy, I don't mean that in a bad way against him, but live, you can hear that guy just kind of going for stuff, and he doesn't always get what he's going for in like the, in a really clean, precise way. But I enjoy that about his playing. Cause I hear him to me, it's about with the live thing, it's really about trying to create a moment, and whether or not you completely, hit the mark or not, as far as where your technique's at. I think if you get there emotionally and have that, I mean, it can be exciting and emotionally, keep you on the edge of your seat and not be executed perfectly. And I actually kind of prefer that. I love listening to guys that are technically proficient, and it's awe-inspiring to me, like Eric Johnson or someone like that. It's sure. Like, forget it, but there's something exciting about hearing someone kind of at the limitation of their technique going for something. And I hear that on some of the stuff on the live record. It's like, wow, I was kind of going for something, and I hear what it was, and I feel as though I got there emotionally, and there's excitement, but I'm not Yngwie by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. But I don't think those two are compatible to some extent. The guys that are incredibly technically like superstars, there's, and the guys that are just going for the emotional rawness, those two generally don't meet.
No, I think especially in this genre, I think it's a part of what gives you that feeling is it's not perfect.
Someone's coming to see a blues show. They don't want perfect. It's
not, I think I strive just for my own sense of, wanting to become a better guitar player. I practice, scales and picking and stuff like that, just so I feel like I'm putting effort into having some sort of control over the instrument and just pushing myself and just staying up on your chops. But when it comes time for the gig, a lot of that stuff kind of goes out the window as far as what you're practicing, but the connection between your left and your right hand are still there. And, I'm happy about that. I'm happy with how it sounds. I thought the performances were good, and we recorded, it's mostly original songs, and the covers that are on there, I feel as though we do differently enough from the originals for the most part, to kind of give a little bit of insight, a little bit of a different vibe for the cover songs. And the other thing about this band live, I don't necessarily consider us, what I think a lot of people would consider like a jam band per se, but we do leave some sections of some songs pretty much open to jam. I mean, great. Really try and create an exciting musical moment in time that you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. I mean, when there's some guidelines, we know maybe how we're going to get out of it. We know, you know, this is the section where we're just going to kind of stay on the one chord and kind of see where it goes. And, you know, it's kind of one of the bands that was sort of another sort of band that I was really into that kind of got me down, started on the trio route when I started my band, was Government Mule.
I've seen them 4 times,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, I got to see the original trio a few times. And musically, you know, Government Mule goes down a lot of twists and turns musically, yeah, that my band doesn't do. But the vibe of having three guys playing amped up blues rock, you know, that's something that's hard to achieve, especially when you start going out on some of those musical limbs. There's a lot of blues trios. There's a lot of, you know, but if you listen to Hendrix and Cream and stuff, those guys would go for it. And sometimes the results weren't always great. You know, I mean, you can hear those guys struggling through stuff sometimes, but I think, again, that's where you're going to find the magic. You're going to find the magic when you don't necessarily know what's going to happen.
Man, I love some of the live stuff, or even the concert footage of Cream with, you know, Ginger and Jack Bruce, and those guys are phenomenal. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I know there's, you know, people that aren't huge fans of that stuff, but I, you know, as far as guys that were young and just kind of going for it in a moment in time, it's inspiring. And just, and talk about ridiculous guitar tone. I mean, forget it.
Yeah. I agree.
So good. So good.
It's funny. You mentioned Mule, a guy I know, John Prestia in Nashville. He is from down here in Florida on the West Coast, and he had a very strong regional band for a while, and Matt Apps often played with him.
Oh, cool.
He shows me this picture one day of an album cover that they all played on before Matt had any tattoos.
Oh,
it was, I was like, holy shit, that's the same guy. Yeah. He goes, yeah. Cause he's like crazy. Very heavily tatted up now. I mean, he's he's skinny little, skinny little kid with blonde hair. I was like, who's that? And he says, that's Matt. I was like, wow.
That's wild.
Hey, you grew up in Santa Barbara. What was your childhood like?
You know, it was pretty mellow, pretty, I would say middle class. You know, I'm the oldest of five.
Oh shit. Wow. Yeah. God bless your parents.
Well, they're not together in part, you know, I'm sure that's part of the reason. You know, my parents got divorced when I was in my late teens, I think. And, but no, it was cool. You know, I, started playing music pretty early on. My mom, you know, like I said, you read in my bio, you know, my mom played piano, and which was, you know, ragtime and some classical. And I took piano lessons a little bit, like third grade or something like that. I think I played violin for a minute, but I started playing saxophone in the fourth grade. And I actually played saxophone all the way through elementary school, junior high, high school, and my first year at Santa Barbara City College. I played tenor sax.
I played tenor sax, funny enough.
Yeah.
Great instrument.
Yeah. And so that's where I learned to read music. And I, you know, I took piano like 3 or 4 years. And when I was in, you know, junior high, and my parents were always supportive of that. You know, they I think early on were like, well, you know, if he's into music, then so be it.
Sure, yeah.
And I actually, before I even played guitar when I was in junior high, I played bass. There was an electric bass in the band director's office. And I said, hey, man, what are the chances of me borrowing that so I can go play Black Sabbath songs with my friend after school? And he's like, yeah, man, take the electric bass home. That's totally cool. But you got to play the upright in the orchestra. And so I played upright for a couple years. And it was when I got to high school that it's like, man, I really want to play guitar. You know, I'd seen pictures of Jakey Lee and her started listening to Ozzy and Van Halen. And I got into hard rock when I was in junior high. But so my parents, you know, they were cool, man. They, you know, took guitar lessons. You know, I had a guy coming. I mean, it was interesting because it was like my dad wanted, I think, you know, someone to teach me classical. And so I took classical lessons, but you know, it was one of those things where it's like, okay, well, then can you show me how to play D by Randy Rhoads? Or can you show me the intro to Killer of Giants by Jakey Lee? And, but he was actually very instrumental in getting me into eventually getting into blues, because, you know, I wanted to do all this, you know, Van Halen stuff, because this would have been, you know, in the mid 80s when I started playing guitar. So that was, you know, the heyday of, you know, a lot of the 80s guitar stuff. And my guitar teacher, Reed Allberger, actually, he's out in Jersey. I've actually, when I toured with Parsons, he came to a couple shows.
He's in Jersey?
Yeah, I think he's in Jersey.
Oh, he moved, obviously.
Yeah, he moved. Okay. And anyhow, so yeah, he was out here and they moved, but he was like, look, man, I know you want to play rock. That's totally cool. But if you want to do that, you got to start here. And he gave me a cassette tape, and I still have this cassette. And it was, you know, Chuck Berry, Johnny B. Goode. It was Cream, Crossroads, and Sunshine of Your Love. Hendrix, Foxy Lady. There was a couple of surf songs on there. There was Freddie King, Hideaway. And, you know, so that was really cool that he kind of had the foresight to go, if you want to play rock, you got to start.
That was cool.
Yeah. And, man. And so, you know, my childhood, being the oldest of five, was interesting. I mean, I, you know, changed diapers and took people to T-ball practice, you know, when I got my license and whatnot. But I think that's also what, you know, I spent a lot of time in my room playing guitar because I didn't want to be around the circus, you know, and, you know, it's not that that's a bad thing, but that, you know, it's like, hey man, there's too much going on out here with the younger siblings. I'm going to, you know, I stayed home on some, you know, I'd go out obviously and do normal kid stuff, but I'd stay home on Fridays and play my guitar.
Any of your brothers or sisters play, instruments?
One of my brothers played trumpet for a little bit. Actually, my grandfather ended up giving him one of his old trumpets before, or maybe it was after he passed. But as you'd mentioned, my grandfather, he played with the Stan Kenton band. Well, it's interesting. My dad kept his mom's last name, which is Green. And technically...
Oh, that's wild.
I'm actually technically an Alvarez. Because that's my dad's dad, was Chico Alvarez. But he kept his mom's last name, which is Green.
That's wild. You know, it's funny because when I read that, I was like, oh, I guess his mom's dad. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of an interesting.
So you're really Alistair Alvarez.
Well, I don't think they would have named me Alistair
if my last name was Alvarez. Yeah, that would have been a push.
But that's
too many fucking A's.
Yeah, too many A's. That's, you know, too much alliteration.
Yeah.
But, so it was cool, man. It was all good. I got to go to college and, you know, they put me through college and I've always been supportive. And one of the coolest things that my dad's said to me was, you know, when I was still living in Santa Barbara, I'd go hiking with him in the morning sometimes. And I was like, I said, you know, dad, you know, I hope you're cool with this whole guitar thing. I mean, you know, hope you're cool. Cause it's like, this is a weird thing. And I know it's, you know, a strange vocation and blah, blah, blah. And he said, one of the coolest things, he said, you know, you may never make a lot of money, but you found something that you love doing, and not everybody finds that.
Very cool.
And I was like, yeah, man, that's what I needed to hear, because it's true. I think, you know, playing guitar is an insane thing to want to do with your life. And, you know, unless you get the Paul McCartney gig or you get the Foo Fighters gig or something like that, and I'm happy for those guys. But I mean, there is not a lot of, financial security a lot of the time when you do that. And it's true, but it's like you fall in love with the guitar and you just want to do whatever you can to kind of keep that train rolling, you know?
What kind of work did your dad do?
He was, he's semi-retired. He still does, some consulting, but he was in the medical field as an administrator for, medical foundations or, you know, like some hospitals and doctor's offices and stuff. And he still does consulting work. And he also teaches part-time. You teach an intro to philosophy class at the Santa Barbara City College. Yeah. And so he was always kind of fighting for people to get medical insurance and medical care.
That's cool.
And he still, you know, he still, you know, does some consulting and stuff. So, you know, some people just, you know, they don't want to retire. They just want to continue to work and be of, value to the world, you know, and he's definitely one of those guys.
I won't retire, man. I'll slow down, but I got to do something, man. I can't just fucking, like, I'll go to the gym like I do and maybe travel more with my wife, but I'm not going to fart around all day and watch television. you have kids yourself?
Nope. My wife and I have cats.
Let me tell you, 5 kids, I bet you that probably like...
that cured me.
Yeah, man, because I'm like, I'm still like 5. I had 3 and it was really, really, really overwhelming.
Yeah.
But 5, it's not like 1.5 times. It's like, you know, exponentially, like maybe you know, to the 9th power at times, this amount of work.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough.
God bless people that want to do that, and obviously that needs to happen to perpetuate the human race. But
I don't know if it needs to happen. And I mean, they're all older now, so it's great. But God, it was rough.
Yeah.
What are some of the bigger obstacles, or like maybe the lower points that you had throughout your career, either personally, music related, or business related, and how did you come through it?
I mean, as you know, when you're trying to play music for a living, it can be pretty daunting as far as just how do you accomplish this? How does it work? There's obviously books that have been written on the music industry and whatnot, but it really is the Wild West. And obviously it's been changing. Obviously, you know, the music business has changed a lot, but you know, the struggle continues. You know, you have good years, you have bad years. I was fortunate along the way to have things that happened that boosted my confidence and would kind of get you through some of those tough times. You know, I worked day jobs up until 11 or 12 years ago. And, you know, when I got called by the guy that played the Pontiacs, I talked about that band earlier, the singer Mitch Kazmar, who's a well-respected harmonica player in the blues world and tours and whatnot. But when he called me one time to sub on guitar at some local bar gig when I was in my early 20s or something, that was one of those moments where it's like, oh, wow, that, you know, like, that's like a real blues band. And he's calling me. I mean, it wasn't like a big festival or some gig with a lot of, you know, it's like a small bar gig. But, you know, that carried me for a while because you end up in your head kind of going, man, did I make the right decision? I don't have any money. This is really difficult. I can't book any gigs or, you know, there's so many head games with that. And so I was fortunate to have things that would happen occasionally that would give me confidence. I played with Ainsley Dunbar for about a year. He'd moved to, he moved to the area and he put out the word that he wanted to put together a band, and he knew some guy here that was like, well, I'm looking for, you know, someone that's some kind of blues rock guitar player. And that list is pretty short in Santa Barbara. So he called me and I went and played with him. We didn't do any gigs, unfortunately, but we did a little bit of recording that ended up on some record that came out in Europe. But, so that gave me a boost where we learned some, you know, the more kind of a little bit more of the easier Zappa songs. And we did some other stuff that he'd played on, some early Journey and whatnot. So little things would happen along the way that would keep me at least feeling as though I wasn't completely out of my mind to want to play guitar. But that said, you know, when you don't have a bunch of money in the bank and you're kind of trying to figure out how to progress, how to take your career to the next level, that's tough. And I think that's why a lot of people stop, is because you do hear the word no a lot, or you don't hear anything when you're trying to book gigs or I used to try and contact record labels or whatever. There's a lot of that, those doors getting shut on you constantly. And that's tough to deal with. And unless you have that, you know, some sort of a drive, or you have these little things that'll happen every once in a while that give you that boost. Yeah. It's a tough thing. And especially as a guitar player, there's so many great guitar players out there. You know, when you think about it, I mean, there's guys in my hometown. Well, I mean, I live in Ventura now, but in Santa Barbara, Ventura, there's guys that I think are just phenomenal guitar players. And, you know, and I just go like, man, I'm really fortunate to be able to get to do what I do and to get to do some of the things that I have done, because there's guys right here that I think, you know, blow me into the weeds.
Yeah.
you know, and some of it's timing, some of it's drive, and some of it's just, you know, insanity. If you all make sure you get a copy of the live record, because in there I wrote, you know, some of the liner notes, and you know, it's 20, the record's 20 songs for 20 years of blues rock stubbornness. I mean, I really think you have to be stubborn too, you know, and I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah, you did. No, you definitely did. Look, are your records, are you self-published or are they on record label?
No, I've actually, the last three records that I've put out have all been on legitimate blues roots labels. And the one before that was on a small Santa Barbara label. The first few that I put out on my own.
That's great, but, man, that you,
yeah. So I've been able to, you know, kind of get that part of the equation. Not, I don't want to say figured out, cause you never figure anything out truly, no. but I've been fortunate that I've been pushing hard enough and, you know, made enough acquaintances and friends in this world where, you know, there's some labels that'll put out my music,
sure.
and that, you know, definitely helps with the distribution and the publicity and, you know, marketing and stuff like that. So yeah, that's one piece of the puzzle that I'm happy that I've been able to fill in.
Well, even the fact that you did the first few on your own, I think you probably learned a ton from that. Should you ever want to do other projects, or should you ever want to put out other people's records, you probably know how to do it now.
Oh, absolutely. I would. Yeah. I mean, I would definitely be interested into getting into production and helping people, you know, get their records together. It's a big process, and you know, more and more people are doing it, and which is good and bad. Anyone can make a record now, but. You know, my first record I started, well, it came out in 2001, but I think I started working on it and recording for it in, you know, 99. That sounds so weird to say 1999 at this point. I mean, how long ago is that?
It's a long time, man.
But yeah, it's a whole process, and I'm glad that I did as much as I did as far as that goes, because now I look back and I go like, wow, man, I've put out some records. That's great. That's part
of it. Dude, you have a massive catalog. Eight albums? That's really good.
Yeah, that's part of what I wanted to do when I was a kid. And so it's kind of that, you know, manifesting those things that you want to achieve.
Good for
you,
man.
And so, yeah, I'm very proud of that for sure.
Awesome, man. You should be. Hey, guitar-wise, gear-wise, what's your go-to guitar right now? And what other two would round out your top three?
Oh, man, that's a tough one.
Do you have tons of guitars?
I don't have a lot. It's funny because, you know, my wife thinks I've got too many, but
she's not a musician.
I think in comparison to, you know, other people, I've got a decent, I think I've got like, you know, eight or nine electrics.
That's really reasonable.
Yeah. Well, you know, recently, you know, fortunately and unfortunately, I went to a chiropractor not that long ago and I saw an X-ray of my back.
Oh yeah. Heavy Les Pauls.
I've actually got it right here. Your listeners won't be able to see this, but since we're on Skype,
yeah.
this is an early 80s
burst, tobacco
Les
burst,
Les Paul standard. And this guitar weighs about 11 pounds.
Nice.
And this was one of my first, this was probably my second good guitar. I got this guitar. I mean, you can see the back of the neck's just worn. I got this guitar in 1993 and this was my main guitar for a long time. I bought a Strat in Boston when I was going to Berkeley in 1990. That's what I call my first good guitar. And I've actually been playing that guitar a lot because, you know, I have a crooked spine and I have compressed discs and I have bone spurs, according to the x-rays that I saw about a month ago. So I've been kind of rethinking my
your 11 pound Les Paul.
I haven't actually played that guitar with any sort of regularity in over a decade. But the guitar that I played with Alan for most of the time I was playing in his band was a chambered Les Paul Standard 2009. Yeah. And that was my favorite guitar, and I still really like it. And so, I mean, that guitar might make my top three. The 57 reissue Strat that I've been playing, again, I'm reconnecting with that. That was, like I said, that was my first good guitar.
You have that handy?
I don't. It's downstairs. I just bought this. This is a, I think it's called a 60s player series Strat. I've been playing this a lot too.
That's made in Mexico.
Yep.
Yes.
I actually really like this guitar. I was playing around with the pickup configuration. So actually it's routed. I tried putting humbuckers in it for a little bit. I actually I actually put a set of the Yngwie Malmsteen pickups in here and for a couple of gigs. But what I have in here right now that I really like are these Seymour Duncan, I think they're called Antiquity Texas Hot pickups. Just put those in there. So that guitar's, I've been playing that a little bit, but I think the winner, if it was like, you can take one guitar with you on the, the 335 is such an amazing instrument. And it really kind of changed how I don't know if it changed how I played, but it really kind of gave me some insight into some of the tones that I'd heard that I really liked. I bought a 330. It's a block neck. It's in that picture that you sent me.
I'm looking at it right now. That photo.
I don't know if it's a reissue. I tried doing a little bit of research on it. I found it on Craigslist actually, and I met the guy down in LA at Norm's Rare Guitars just to kind of make sure, just to have them look at it for a second and make sure it was what the guy told me
was. Are they cool with doing that?
They were a little bit dicky, to be honest.
I was just like,
look, man, I'll buy something. I'll buy a fucking strap and a shirt or something. Can you just look at this for 10 seconds and just let me know if this is an actual Gibson?
Yeah.
And, they gave me a little bit of attitude, but I get it. I understand why they did, because I'm going in there. But this guy that I bought the guitar from, I think it bought a bunch of stuff.
And
then
you're going in there, you're like, hey, listen, I'm going to give you no money and use your intellectual property intelligence.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Is that cool? No, because I've bought guitars from guys and they're always like, hey, I'll meet you at Sam Ash. I'm like, man, is that really cool? Like, oh yeah, they know me there. And I'm like, fuck, if they know you, great. Cause they don't know me. Which is even better.
That's what this guy said. He's like, I know those guys. No, it was fine. It was all right. And then I did buy a strap and a shirt and I wore the shirt on tour so I feel as though I did them a solid.
You did your karmic duty.
I did my karmic duty to make sure everyone knows that that's the place to go in Los Angeles if you want to get a vintage cigar. So I just did it again.
That's right.
But that guitar, what did I put in that? I put a couple of, I've got Seymour Duncans in that. I think I've got the 59, a set of 59 humbuckers. But that guitar, I would love to travel with it if it wasn't such a risk. And there's guys, I know guys that put 335s underneath airplanes all the time. I just don't know if I
could. Oh, man, that's so delicate.
You know what I mean? Yeah, but that guitar is really, it's really special. I recorded a lot with that on Dream Train. On the live record, I played the 335 on a lot of songs. So that, that guitar is pretty special. It's not necessarily all that old. I think it's like a 2005. Mm. I don't think it's a reissue. I would have to check. I was trying to do some research on it. It's got I wanted the block neck, not the dot neck. I wanted the blocks.
Why? Just aesthetically, you just like about it?
Aesthetically, well, that's what Clapton played with Cream. He played a block neck 335.
Okay. That's cool.
BB King or, those guys, it was usually, it looked like, usually block necks, even though those were 345s or 355s or whatever. But that guitar is really, really cool. So, I think the top three would be that and my 57 reissue Strat and then my chambered Les Paul are probably my favorites. But, this is a cool guitar. I actually use this a lot at home. I took one of these out on the road with Alan a little bit. It's a Steve Morse model, Man.
So can you hold that up a little bit?
Yeah, it's the Y2D.
Okay.
So I put Seymour's in this too. I think Steve has a DiMarzio thing.
Dude, this is a Duncan commercial here.
Yeah, I know. Well, I've known Seymour since I was 15 or 16 years old. He was at the first gig I ever played with a rock band in Santa Barbara. So I've known Seymour forever. But this is a really cool guitar. I took one of these on tour with Alan. Actually, here's an interesting story. I reconnected with these guitars. We opened up for Deep Purple in Canada in 2014 or 15.
That's wild. Alan Parsons opening up for Deep Purple.
It was a last minute thing. A band canceled. I think originally Deep Purple was going to open for Nickelback at this outdoor thing. Okay. And then Nickelback canceled, and we'd just been to Canada with Alan playing some you know, theater shows. And the promoter, when that happens, like, well, let's get Alan Parsons up here to open for Deep Purple. And it was like this multi-day festival. And it was probably the biggest gig I've ever played. This outdoor place in Quebec. And I actually had reached out to Ernie Ball saying, hey, you know, I'm going to be opening up for Purple with Alan Parsons. Any chance you can put me in touch with Steve's tech? I'd love to go early and hang, whatever. So they put me in touch with Tommy, and I went and, you know, messaged him and went to the sound check early and went and hung out, was checking out some gear. I'm a big Steve Morse fan. And he's like, hey man, you want to play through the rig? And I was like, sure. So like he handed me, you know, Steve's guitar, and, you know, through this full volume, you know, multiple stack thing. And there was like this empty field, you know, in Canada. And I got to play Steve's guitar through his rig.
How loud was that?
It was fucking loud. Because that band, it's interesting because they don't, you know, there's some side fills for Ian Gillan's vocals. Don Airey has a monitor for the keyboards. Ian Pace has a monitor back by the drums. But that's it. It's all stage volume. It's old school, man. Because with Alan, you know, we had in-ear monitors. The stage volume's pretty, you know, mellow. Because there's, you know, a lot of keyboards plugged in and shit. Yeah. So it was, you know. So I never really played all that loud with Alan. And so I plugged in, you know, and I played Steve Morse's rig, and it's just like, wow. So I got, I talked to Music Man about getting a Y2D, and, you know, they gave me a deal on one. And so the next tour we did, we went to Europe, and there was two shows that we were doing with Deep Purple again in Germany. And so I went out there and had my guitar, and then Steve's text like, well, hey man, I talked to Steve. I asked him if he wanted to try your guitar out tonight on a couple of songs. And I'm like, oh, great. And then he was like, hey, you want to use one of his as a backup, you know, for your, and I was like, great. So it's like, I, you know, one of Steve's guitars is my backup guitar. And then Steve played my guitar on, I don't remember what song it was. I've got some video, and it was cool. I mean, I don't, you know, Steve, I mean, when I run into Steve now, I mean, it's cool because he remembers me from those shows or whatever.
Oh, that's nice.
But yeah. And he's such a sweet guy and, you know, supporter of young guys, you know, trying to find their way through this music business thing. I don't know if you ever used to read his column, and I don't know if it was Guitar Player, but he had really insight. It was, I don't remember what it was called, but there's a book you can buy. It's the Steve Morse book of just all these columns. And it just has real insightful stuff to say about trying to make it playing guitar. It's just, he's done it. You know, that guy's been there and done it. And he struggled for a lot of years. I mean, the Dixie Dregs are legendary now, but I think they were just playing clubs in the South until they, you know, finally kind of, you know, got bigger. So he knows what it's like to go play the little shows, and he certainly knows what it's like to play the big ones.
It's funny. One of the things I've learned from doing all these interviews is lots of bands were regional. Like I grew up in New York City. I never heard the Dregs ever.
Yeah. Right.
Ever. And there were lots of bands, you know, there was a good chunk of bands that were from the South or from out West that, you know, I kind of knew about them, but they never popped up on anybody's radar. You know, it's just weird. And that they're one of them, unfortunately.
Well, it's the same thing now. I mean, with the internet, you know, a lot of things have been connected, and you can find out from music, but, you know, there's a, like some of the guys that we were talking about earlier, Damon Fowler or Albert Castillo. Albert Castillo was just out here on the West Coast, but it takes a lot to go from one side of the country to another in a van. And there's guys that can do it. And I mean, I haven't been able to do that with my band. We've done some touring. We've been to the Midwest, you know, but my band's been more regional as far as playing California and the West Coast. And, you know, we've gotten out to Vegas and Arizona, but it really does take a lot to get from one coast to the other. Well, there's a lot of that. And then even just California, I mean, there's a desert and a mountain range between where I live and where most of the gigs are, which is the Midwest, and where you're at in the Eastern Seaboard. Yeah. There's, you know, it's a long way to go.
Oh, it's huge, man. Yeah. Hey, do you remember the first record or CD that you got?
Oh, Lucky for you, I've got it right here.
Is that random, or did you just like have it there?
No, did you want to see the? Are you talking about the one that I bought with my own money?
Oh, I don't know, man. You're qualifying okay. this more than
All
I am.
All right, well, here it is. This is the record, and I've got it right here, that I spent my own money on to purchase. What this is not my mom's record collection.
Def Leppard. What? Pyromania.
That's it, buddy. It's right here. This is the first vinyl I ever purchased with my own money.
Good record.
Yeah. Man. Well, I mean, my mom's record collection was the Beatles and Stevie Wonder and Leon Russell and Elton John, which is all killer stuff. But I started hearing this stuff on the radio, and that was my first kind of exposure to hard rock. And second after that was a friend of mine's older brother had like the early Iron Maiden records.
Yeah, those good records.
Man. And that was when I was like, oh man, what's that? What's that guitar set? You know, what is that? And then I started paying attention to the guitar. And then it was, you know, Van Halen and Ozzy. And then from there, you know, I ended up kind of going backwards pretty early and, you know, getting into Zeppelin and Cream. And then I, you know, a friend of my dad's loaned me some blues records. And that's when I got into Buddy Guy and B.B. King and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Johnny Winter and the Allman Brothers Band. But yeah, man, it started with Def Leppard. And I'll tell you, the first CDs I bought, I know those and I've got those around here somewhere. I was a holdout. I was like, I'm not getting into CDs. I'm staying vinyl. You know, I'm staying vinyl and cassette tape.
And what was your first CD?
Yeah, the first CDs was when I went to Berkeley in Boston. So this would have been 1990. The first two CDs I bought were Stevie Ray Vaughan, Texas Flood, and Eric Johnson, Tones.
Oh, that's cool. Good records.
Those are the first two CDs that I ever bought. So.
It's funny. I remember the first CD I bought was Jethro Tull. I wasn't even a big Tull fan. Jethro Tull. I don't know why. Yeah. And it was a current CD at the time, which is in the early 80s, early to mid 80s, I guess.
Interesting.
Yeah. Weird.
Was that the year they beat out Metallica for the Grammy?
I don't know, but I wound up interviewing Martin Barr.
Oh, cool.
Tull's guitarist. Yeah. Good guy. Yeah, yeah. Really.
We did some shows with Alan, where, what's the singer's name again?
Ian Anderson.
Ian Anderson opened. We did a show in Germany. He opened for
That's
Alan.
A fit. That's a fit.
Yeah. And actually, one of the Purple shows that we opened for Purple in Germany, he was before us. So it was Ian Anderson, Alan Parsons, Live Project, and Deep Purple at one of the shows.
Very cool.
And his guitar, the guy he's got playing guitar, I can't remember this guy's name. We got to talk to him a couple times. Young guy, nice kid. Played a Les Paul. Really good. I mean, just nailed all that. Tull stuff,
yeah.
You know, really you had that tone. There's some good guitar tone. I mean, I was never a huge Jethro Tull fan, but the guitar tone on those records, man, Martin Barr was a badass.
Yeah, he's no great tone. I only like really more the earlier stuff. Very like first two, three albums I was really passionate about.
Yeah.
Desert Island Discs, man. No particular order. Just for today, knowing that you could, they will change tomorrow.
Yeah, that's I always say whatever my top 10 is today is going to be different tomorrow.
Absolutely, man.
Some of the stuff that got me into playing blues and blues rock, you know, B.B. King Live at the Regal is just a classic guitar record. Allman Brothers, Fillmore East. I mean, that's, you know, that's cheating a little bit because that's two records. But, man, there's so much great stuff on that album.
Do you have the newer one, the, you know, with everything?
I do.
Oh, that's incredible.
I've got a couple different things. I've got, I guess there's like an extended one or whatever.
It came out like 10 or 15 years ago now, I think.
You know, a record I've really been digging on that actually I'd heard some cuts off of, but I hadn't heard the whole record. Until we were on a road trip with our drummer Austin brought in, but it's a Freddie King record called Burglar.
Great record. I have
that's it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Funky, great songs, you know.
He's my favorite of the three Kings, man, by far. Yeah, I love him.
Yeah, I mean, he's just, he's unbelievable. Man, I, you know, this is how many do I have to name?
That's it, man. You're already
yeah,
three.
John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, though, with Clapton.
Beano.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's hard, man. That's a tough one. You can, you know, start picking records out all day long that are ones that you'd want to keep forever, but.
Good stuff, man.
Yeah.
What, What's the most important thing you've learned about yourself over this journey?
Well, that I sometimes I underestimate my ability to step into a musical situation and hang, and I've learned that I can. And it's taken a lot of work to do that, but I've also found out that I'm willing to put in that work.
That's awesome, man.
That because is, it's yeah, because it's daunting.
That's really cool.
You know, well, the Parsons gig was part of that. Playing with Ainsley was part of that. You know, even now getting to go, you know, Walter Trout asks you to come sit in. It's like, man, I don't want to look like an idiot, you know, and it's just kind of having confidence in yourself, not being cocky. No. I don't feel cocky, but it's just like, you know, when you, it's like, man, I can do this. Yeah. You know, I'm 47. I should be able to get up on stage with pretty much anyone in the genre and not look like an asshole.
It's funny. That's one of the, I think that's one of the universal things that, of almost everybody I've spoken with that has, I've asked that question to, that is probably the most common response of, you know, some version of, I'm really okay with me now.
Yeah.
You know? And it's, yeah. It's, unfortunate. It takes us 45, 50 years to be okay with us because it's like, fuck, yeah. That sucks. Yeah. We should have been okay with us at 25, man.
You know? I know. No, it's one of those things. I think, you know, part of being a guitar player or even a musician in general, I mean, I think there is that insecurity and that vulnerability. But I think that's also what makes us artists. And that sounds, using the word artist can sometimes sound
I know how you mean it.
But you know what I mean? To be a musician that's communicating and has something to say that people are going to gravitate to, a lot of the times, especially in this genre, I mean, it does mean that you're sensitive. And if you're sensitive, then you are going to have self-doubt about things. And, but yeah, man, I mean, that's probably the thing I've learned. It's like, man, I can do this. And, you know, cause I think playing music also, you tend to retain childlike aspects because it's fun. I get excited when I see a guitar and I think that's part of that is there's kind of, you kind of keep that childlike interest in playing and the music and stuff, you know?
Totally get that, man. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
That I own some Slayer records. yeah, I don't know. Well, I like to cook, you know, I mean, I'm a guitar geek. I like to cook and yeah, I mean, I have for a blues rock guy, I probably own more heavy metal records than some people might expect.
Man. Good for you, man. Do you do most of the cooking at home?
I do.
That's cool.
I do most of the cooking. Yeah. I'm big into that.
What do you cook? What's going on at the greenhouse, old man?
Oh man. You know, I do a lot of different stuff, but you know, primarily I try to, you know, I mean, I don't have a lot of stuff, but I try, you know, what am I proud of? I've been grilling a lot. When the weather's nice, I try and grill, you know, whatever, fish, chicken, but we'll do pork and steak sometimes. I pride myself on making pasta sauce that I like. We're trying not to do as much of the actual pasta, so we'll steam some broccoli and cauliflower, and I'll just make some ridiculous, you know, sauce that's just mostly, you know, vegetables and whatever. But, and I like, you know, actually one thing that I don't do as much, because as you grow older, your digestive system changes, but I used to make some really hot salsa.
Yeah.
My wife's Hispanic. Obviously I've got a little bit of Hispanic in here too. And we live close to a Hispanic neighborhood. And I went over one time to this, one of those little mom and pop markets. And I was buying some, I don't remember. I was buying some peppers and some onions or whatever, and some jalapenos. And the guy behind the counter was like, are you making salsa? I'm like, yeah, was it that obvious? He's like, you should try this. So I got like some tips from like a real deal.
Insider's tips.
Yeah, tips on, you know, on some different chilies and some peppers and some different things like that. And yeah, man, I used to make some really crazy salsa and that would be my Christmas present that I would give to people. But then, you know, no one would eat it because it was just blow your fucking ass out hot, you know. So, but it's good, you know. I probably got that from my mom because my mom likes a lot of spicy food. So, yeah, you know, heavy metal and cooking, man.
There you go. That's a good idea with that, because you know what? We when we were kids, I've been with my wife a long time. We used to make like on a Friday night, we had no money. We would make, buy a cheap bottle of wine and make sauce together.
Oh, nice.
And we do that once in a while now, but I don't eat pasta ever. You know, I'm like pretty healthy, and not that it's not unhealthy, but I'm always you know, in the gym watching my weight or whatever. But
right.
And I'm like, I like, that's a good idea though, man, to get some, make it with some broccoli. That's a, you know, or just mixed vegetables in general. Put you it on, even get, put them on the grill.
You get these little contraptions. You can take a zucchini, and I don't know what it does, but it, you basically grind it into this contraption and it turns it into strands. So you can make zucchini strands and use that as like the,
like
the spaghetti.
Yeah,
exactly. So
that's good. You know, good ideas.
Well, a couple health tips.
Couple of health tips, some music, some guitar. Yeah, we get everything here. Most important person in your life.
Well, you know, I it depends, you know, in my personal life, it's my wife, because she's just been so supportive of me. And in my musical life, you know, my grandfather's still a big inspiration. You know, I think about him a lot. You know, my wife's, you know, been really supportive. I've been with her for, we've been married for over 10 years and together for almost, you know, 20. But
dude, that's a long time for, if you're 46 years old. That's good. Good for you, man.
And yeah, I mean, I lose track of time, as most people do. But, you know, when I think about music, you know, one of the things that I, you know, kind of endeavor to do is, because my grandfather passed away before I really got to a place where I was really, you know, doing music a lot. And, you know, I was just home from college, I think, when he passed. So I hadn't really started playing in rock bands and stuff. So, you know, I think about him a lot as just kind of an inspiring driving force in my life. It's one of those things where, you know, I would like for him to be, depending on what your belief system is, I would like for him to be proud of what I'm doing and the effort that I'm putting in and carrying on, even though I don't have his last name, you know, carrying on the music and stuff. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you think about your life and there's a lot of important people, you know, along the way that are either still with us or not, you know.
That's nice, so, man. Thank you for sharing that, man.
Of course.
Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music and cooking?
And collecting vinyl.
And collecting guitars.
Collecting guitars, right. You know, it's not, you know, I used to be more into watching football, and I still watch a little bit of football. I got a little bit disenfranchised with football after I saw the movie Concussion, unfortunately. But, you know, I have a passing interest in sports. I've been trying to get more into baseball because it's not as violent.
Yeah,
I've been trying to get a little bit more into baseball. You know, I love our cats. You know, I wouldn't say I'm an animal activist per se, but
you can say that if you'd like.
Other than taking care of the animals that we have.
Sure, I guess.
You know, I don't do a lot, you know, outside of that. Maybe that's something that I will get into at a certain point if I can, you know, if I have the time and the energy to put into that. But I think animals are a very important part of our lives. As far as, you know, I hesitate to use the word pet because it's like you coexist with these creatures and you're taking care of them, but they take care of you too. If you let them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really there just literally to be loved and to love. Yeah. And that's a huge, huge thing. I've, you know, had some dogs in the past, but you know, my wife had a cat when we first got together I have allergies and all kinds of crazy shit. So like I was, you know, crazy allergic for, but now I'm immune because I'm around them all the time. So it's
lucky,
you actually develop an immunity. But, if I'm gone, like if I'm gone for a week or two and I come back, I have a day where it's like my body readjusts and my eyes are watering and I'm sneezing. But no, man, I think animals are a hugely important part of our lives. And even not even just dogs and cats. I mean, just out there in the world.
Animals in the world. I agree with you, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty inspiring. So, you know, whenever I see, you know, people not taking care of their animals and stuff like that, it's definitely an emotional trigger for me.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way about like, any kind of, sort of, I guess, predatory behavior, man. I don't think that's cool at all, you know?
Yeah.
I don't like that. But we have cats too. We've had dogs. We just lost a couple. Yeah. So I know how you feel.
Yeah.
Man.
It's heartbreaking.
Two more questions, man. What is the favorite place you've traveled?
The favorite or the weirdest, or maybe it's one and the same.
Could be, man. Talk about both. It'll be even more interesting.
One of the cool things touring with Alan was he'd get asked to do gigs in some places that not every band goes to. So, we did a gig in Mumbai, India.
What was that like? That's one of the big cities there, isn't it?
That was eye-opening. I mean, it was sad.
Yeah.
The poverty level in a lot of these countries, unless you actually see it firsthand, it's hard to kind of grasp. Yeah. And that's not to diminish what we have here in the United States as far as that goes. It's not to say you can't go to Detroit or you can't go to New York.
West Virginia.
Wherever it is, you know, but when you get to a country that the country in and of itself, you know, the majority of the population is living way below whatever standards, you know, we would have here. So that was really eye opening, and it's a long way away. But yeah, it was really sad, man. I mean, we had a great gig and we were treated really well, but you know, you see, you know, the kids begging for money on the street and stuff like that. And I was, that kind of helped with my perception of everyone will complain about something at some point, unless you're, you know, a saint or, you know, you're whatever. But I've really tried to not complain. I made an effort to not, feel grateful for, yeah, maybe your career isn't where you want it to be and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, hey, I've got 200 CDs sitting right here in front of me.
You're not living in abject squalor.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So, that was interesting. The country that I really like that I'm hoping at some point to get back to and is Germany. I really like Germany as far as just, you know, the way it's organized and the people and the travel and the, you know, I mean, it's not, you don't want to go there and try and lose weight.
it's not a healthy eating.
You know, but that's a really special place. And I'm, you know, I know we haven't mentioned this yet, but you know, I'm going to be going over to Europe in a few weeks playing guitar with Sugar Ray Rayford, who's a great blues and R&B soul funk musician, and so I'm going to be getting a chance to go back over to Europe, and I'm looking forward to that.
That's great, man.
It's hard to pick a favorite place. There's definitely some unusual places that I've been. I've played, you know, two gigs in Tel Aviv with Alan, and that's not a place that everybody gets to go.
Yeah.
On tour, and that was pretty special to get to go there, and we took I think both times I was there we took day trips to Jerusalem, and I'm not like a hugely religious person. I consider myself a spiritual person, you know, but sure. Jerusalem's kind of a heavy spot when it comes to that kind of thing, and well, that was pretty cool. But yeah, man, I feel very fortunate that I've gotten to do the amount of traveling that I have, and I do owe that to my, you know, time playing with Alan, regardless of, you know, my other feelings surrounding why I left or why, you know, that kind of stuff. I feel as though I had a really good run and was very, you know, fortunate to get to experience some of that stuff, you know.
Well, too, reality is, you know, the old saying, people come into your life for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. Well, a lifetime ain't going to happen. You know, you got one or two of those. You know, most people's going to be a reason or a season. Him was like a pretty good season.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so you got to look at that one, man.
Yeah, totally.
And I lied, actually. I'm going to ask you two more questions. Toughest decision you ever had to make or hardest thing you've ever had to do?
Well, on that topic.
that same topic.
Cool. No, I mean, well, you know, I mean, that was a big one. You know, I mean, I think, you know, just in music going forward, you know, you do have to make tough decisions. There was a band early on that I was in, you know, similar thing where I was becoming unhappy and it was also at the time I wanted to sing, and it was a band of, you know, it was probably the first and last time I was in like a true band by the definition of the word, where we were all close friends. We wrote, you know, or I would at least, I co-wrote a lot of songs with the singer and the, you know, some of the guys in the, you know, the bass player in the band was an old childhood friend, and we'd really developed a really close bond. And I consider it my first serious band. It was when I came home from Berkeley from 92 to 95 or so. It was a band called Scarecrow. And you know, when I, you know, decided to break up that band or leave the band, you know, the drummer and the bass player were in another band at the same time that ended up getting signed and putting out a record and stuff. And I kind of saw that writing on the wall. And that was a tough decision because I was going off on my own. And then I was going to try and figure out how to sing and front a band. And that was a big, that was a big deal. And it was sad. And we got together and cried and everything, but you know, it ended up working out, and I'm still friends with all the guys, and the singer I still play with occasionally. And he was the best man in my wedding, you know? So it's like,
cool, man.
Yeah. You know, so it's like, I'm still, you know, the bass player and I are still best friends, and he lives 7 minutes away from me. That's but great. That was a year 20, whatever that would have been, 23 years old. And it's your first, you know, band. And that taught me a lot too about friendship and what it means to be in a band, because that's a different thing than being a band leader and having sidemen. It's different from being a sideman. Being in an actual band is very unique and very special. And I haven't had that experience since, as far as that feeling of camaraderie. And it also makes you really appreciate and know how special it is when you see a band like, you know, pick one of the great bands, pick the Beatles or Led Zeppelin or whatever it is. Those guys had known each other for a long time, and then they got to experience this great thing, and it broke some of those friendships apart or whatever. But that was a big deal for me to break that band up and go, I'm going to sing, I'm going to front a power trio, you know, and that was, you know, hey, call it insanity or balls. I don't know. Well,
call it both, but you know what? Here you are 21 years later and 8 records. So fucking congratulations to you, man.
Right on.
And last question, what's been the biggest change in your personality, Alistair, over the last 10 years? And how much of this has been deliberate and intentional, and how much is just a part of aging?
That's a great question, man. I think simultaneously I've become more compassionate in a lot of ways, as mentioned, you know, by some of the touring experience that I had and seeing the world and feeling grateful. And I've also probably become a little bit more, pick a word, dickish, assholeish. Or, no, but just, I don't have as much tolerance and patience for some things, kind of because of that. Like when you kind of see, you know, how bad life can be for some people and stuff, your tolerance for certain kinds of bullshit, I think, goes down. And that's just, you know, I think that's part of that's getting older and part of that's experience. It's like, you just don't have time for, you know, you realize how short life is. And sometimes you might come off like an asshole sometimes because you just don't have the time for something, and you're not going to be able to make every, I mean, you know, there are some guys that maybe are the nicest guy in the world all the time, but you can catch anybody on a bad day.
And
you have to kind of realize, it's like, you know, maybe I just caught him on a bad day, or maybe his tolerance for bullshit got reached that day, and that's what it is.
So you just suffer fools. You have a less, which I totally get, man.
Yeah.
Good for you, man. Hey, listen, I can't thank you enough. You're a real sweet guy, and thank you for being so candid
absolutely.
You know, all open. And I want to just tell people how to find you. First of all, it's Alistair Green. Let me spell his name. It's 3 A's in the first name, 3 E's in the last name, A-L-A-S-T-A-I-R, and Green with an E.
G-R-E-E-N-E,
and it's alistairgreen.com. Talk about your tour. You're headed off to Europe soon.
Yeah, well, I, you know, real briefly, you know, I have been leading my band, but, you know, we were talking about finance, we were talking about all that kind of stuff, talking about spirituality. I put it out to the universe about 6 months ago, as he takes a drink of water. I put it out to the universe that I was willing to do some side guy work again. And basically because it's like, I need to pay bills and I need to work, and this is what I do. So really quick, you know, I got a call and I was going to audition for Danny Serafin, who's the original drummer from Chicago, but that kind of fell through. And then I actually got a call to go audition for, and I did go audition for Steve Perry.
Oh, wow.
And you know, it's it remains to be seen if he's going to tour or whatever, but you know, he just put out a new record and stuff and he's been, you know, popping up again. And so I did that. And then this thing came up with Sugar Ray Rayford where his guitar player left and his agent, you know, put in a word for me with him and we got together. So I'm going to go do some touring with him. And I'm really, really excited musically. It's a challenge and it's a lot closer to my wheelhouse as far as being based on blues and funk and R&B. So I'm going to do a little run with him next week up the West Coast. And then we're going to go to Europe in November. And we're, you know, the, his website is sugarrayblues.com, but I'm going to be doing that. And I've got some gigs with my band in December going up the West Coast again. And then we'll kind of see what next year brings, you know.
Good for you, man.
Could be a lot of Sugar Ray Rayford gigs, and I'm excited about that because, like I said, man, I'm a guitarist first and foremost. So
good for you. Tell Sugar Ray to get his ass over here to Florida, man.
Yeah, man. Well, hopefully we'll be out there, man. I'd love to come out.
And please check out Alistair's last record. Again, it's called Live from the 805, 2 CDs, 20 songs. You can find it on his website. Again, it's Alistair Green, 3 A's in his first name and 3 E's in his second name. He also, based on availability, is around for Skype lessons. And I guess is there like a contact tab on your website?
Yeah.
For that?
If you go to my website, there's an email and everything. Yeah. So all that.
Awesome. And he's also on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Alistair Green or Alistair Green Official. And he's also on YouTube. He's got a pretty cool channel there, man. Dude, thank you again. I really appreciate your time.
Hey, man, I appreciate you coming on.
Any final
coming on your show?
Yeah. No, it's all good, bro. Any final words of wisdom?
Words of wisdom. Well, I'm not going to be like Dave Mustaine in The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2. I'm not going to be that guy. Don't do it.
Yeah.
No, man, if you love playing guitar, which I think is, you know, your listeners are going to be the ones, it's like, do it because you love. I mean, it's cliche, and I found out the hard way that there's a reason why cliches exist in the world. It's because most of them are true. But if you're going to do it because you really love doing it. Okay. I mean, I hate to say it, and if I was to tell that to my 17-year-old self, my 17-year-old self would flip off my 47-year-old self. But that's true, man. If you want to do it because you love it, not because you think you're going to make a bunch of money.
What did Mike Bloomfield say? If you love the blues, play them as you please. Right?
Play them as you please. That's it. Yeah.
Thanks, dude. I appreciate everything.
Man, thank you so much.
Everybody, you're welcome. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We certainly appreciate your support. Thanks again to Alistair Green for spending time with us. Please check him out on the road, my listeners in Europe, and check out his website, alistairgreen.com. Last record is Live from the 805. He's a really, really hot blues player if you haven't heard him. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.